Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Cindy F. Solomon coming to you today with the Global Product Management Talk. It is July 23rd, and we are discussing innovation, the result of the intersection of invention and value, with Jose Brioni, PhD, and joining us today as co-host is Therese Padilla, who is president of the AIPMM. The Global Product Management Talk can be followed on Twitter using the hashtag #PRODMGMTTALK. That is also our website, and you can follow us on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. We are a weekly discussion of pre-posted questions with live audio of thought leader and co-hosts to bring product talk to product people who cannot leave their desks every week to engage in product talk. One of the biggest problems that a product manager encounters when starting an innovation program is to reach consensus on the definition of innovation. This is more than a mere semantics issue. Without agreement on exactly what the goal is, the team is unlikely to achieve it. The traditional definition of innovation has been simply a new method, idea, or product. Our speaker today will prove that this definition of innovation is obsolete and that being new is not enough for something to be called innovative. He proposes a definition of innovation as the intersection of invention and value. Jose will discuss how the magnitude of incremental value that the invention brings to the user or to the market subsequently defines the innovation as either incremental, radical, or disruptive. This definition applies not just to products, but also to services, business models, or business processes. The implications of Jose's definition are that different types of innovations must be managed differently within the product development process and product management lifecycle. A little bit about our speaker, Jose Briones is currently the Director of Operations at Spirotech Performance Solutions, a supplier of innovation management services. He holds management and board positions with several companies, including Spot Tracking Systems, Celeritas Chemicals, Green Chemistries Corporation, Natural Rubber and Smarty Ears LLC. He's also an advisory board member of the DFW Product Group and brings 20 years of commercial and technical experience in the manufacturing industry, holding positions in the areas of marketing, innovation, sales, engineering, and research and development with Fortune 300 companies. He's been the commercial or technical leader in the launch and commercialization of over 35 new products for a variety of applications and end-user segments, and has been named as inventor in 5 different patents. We are delighted to have Jose returning. He has been a frequent speaker on the Global Product Management Talk. And our co-host today is Therese Padilla. She's the president of the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. She's a product management professional with broad experience in all areas of product development and management, including consumer products, enterprise software and startups, and large corporate environments. She created the first product management certification program at the AIPMM, which she co-founded in 1998. And I am Cindy F. Solomon. You can follow me on Twitter at Cindy F. Solomon and also view my background at Cindy F. Solomon, SOLOMON.com. A shout out and thank you to our sponsor, who is the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, which promotes worldwide excellence in product management education and provides value to its individual members, corporate members, and sponsors by providing training, education, certification, and professional networking opportunities. The AIPMM 7-Stage Product Lifecycle Framework is a vendor-independent product management and product marketing standard that takes into account best practices used in a wide range of companies and industries. This ensures that the most modern and up-to-date challenges faced in product management and product marketing are addressed for today's environment. The framework is part of the AIPMM product body of knowledge, the ProdBox, that was developed with input from over 50 experts and endorsed by more than half a dozen consulting companies. The framework includes 7 distinct product phases from conceived to end of life and covers all aspects during the entire product life cycle. Please visit our sponsor, the AIPMM, at www.aipmm.com. At the end of today's broadcast, we'll tell you about some exciting product events, webinars, and future product talks coming up. Okay, so welcome, Jose. Welcome, Therese. Welcome our tweeters. Welcome Elizabeth, who is joining us from Austin, Texas.
Cindy, thank you very much for having us here. Origin of this discussion, you might say, comes from what I call innovation fatigue. The problem out there is that companies set up innovation programs, and they spend a great deal of time, a great deal of work, launch a number of products, and innovation, as you know, is a difficult business. You get a lot of failures. And then people fall into what's called innovation fatigue. You say, okay, if we're so innovative, if we're having so many new products, why aren't we making any money? That's really the problem. That's the root of the problem. Well, I always say, in order for you to make money, in order to actually be successful in the marketplace, you have to offer value. So the whole origin of this definition came about from those two points of view, which is we have the old definition of innovation, the new product, and you have now how you're going to make money by offering value to the customer. So that's how, in the end, it became innovation has to be now a successful innovation or a successful innovation program. The target must be the marriage of the intersection between an invention, which is now an invention, is what the new product is, and value. So that's really the origin of this definition.
So how do you define the invention then, Jose?
To me, invention is now becomes the old innovation definition. If you invent something, you simply created something new. In other words, if you go to Google, the definition of innovation, 9 out of 10 definitions today will be new product, new service, new something. To me now, that must be the definition of invention. You're creating a new offering. You invented something. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily it's going to be successful in the marketplace. The market is littered with new offerings that are not successful commercially. I call that's an invention. You brought something new to the marketplace. It simply was not enough to be successful. It did not offer value. So to me, what's happened is really people confuse invention with innovation. Invention is the creation of something new. Now, in order to be innovative, to offer something that people will accept, that people will actually want, has to offer value.
Okay. I'm trying to think about this in terms of, we think of all types of products, and you said something that started me thinking, innovation fatigue, because you come up with so many ideas, you're so innovative, but you're not making money. And it made me think of the movie industry for some reason, because there seems to be no real innovation in movies, but there's sometimes movies are considered innovative based on their special effects or something like that. But there's the movie itself, the plot, the whole thing is basically the same thing over again, but it's just packaged differently. Can you see that corollary in different types of products? Is that what I'm talking about?
Unquestionably. I think this definition is applicable, again, to anything, not just products, services, business models, manufacturing processes. It doesn't matter. It really still boils down to the same thing. Technology is not enough. It's like I think in general in movie, that's really the situation. People confuse technology or new technology and a new way to do special effects with real value. Yeah, that a new technology may appeal to a very narrow segment of the public, but not to a large enough segment of the public to be successful. In other words, the entire movie, all the components that a movie is today, as you mentioned, the plot, the acting, the script, the technology and the special effects, the entire movie did not offer enough value in the marketplace to be successful. For some people, the technology now will be appealing, which brings us to the point of market segmentation. but it's not a large enough segment for the entire movie to be successful. So yes, the definition is applicable. It's not necessarily exclusive to products. It's offerings, any type of offering as well. But the key is to keep in mind, inventing something is not enough for it to be successful in the marketplace. The number of patents, in fact, is no longer enough to determine if a company is innovative. You can do a lot of basic R&D, get a lot of patents, and still make no money. That's where it really comes from. How do you convert this into actual successful commercializations?
Well, then how do you measure the value that it delivers? If it's a call, comes down to the value to the individual, how do you measure that and how do you key in on that?
That is an exceptional question, and that's of course the subject of almost an entire different discussion, but try to provide a basic definition of value. In my mind, the key is two dimensions to value. One of them is there has to be an unmet need, and that unmet need could be, and of course, you've heard it from marketing Maslow hierarchy of needs, and that there's an unmet need that your product is addressing. So depending on what type of unmet need you're addressing and the magnitude of the unmet need, that's the value you're delivering. So that's one way to looking at it. But there has to be an unmet need out there that you're meeting in some way, shape, or form. And you may not necessarily meet it entirely. You may meet it halfway. So that's how much value you're delivering. But you may need it 100%, or you may exceed the unmet need. That's a problem too, by the way. There may be an unmet need out there, and your product far surpasses the unmet need out there, and therefore people may reject it just based because you're offering them too much and it's too expensive. So that's the first definition that I might on value. Now, value could be an unmet need that's existing or an unmet need that you create. What do I mean by that? Well, marketing managers, of course, have their jobs based on creating unmet needs out of thin air, as you know. why can a pair of shoes be sold for $500 or $1,000? Because they create an unmet need. But it's still an unmet need when you think about it. They're creating it. People have an unmet need to be fashionable, an unmet need to look good, an unmet need to feel important. Now, the fact that marketing folks that create that out of thin air, well, that's their business. That's what they do. But it's still meeting an unmet need. That's how I define value.
Okay. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about the unmet need of fashion as the difference between a $500 watch and a $10,000 watch.
I mean, branding, the entire segment or the entire discipline of branding is around creating an unmet need on status, period.
Okay. I'm trying to equate all this because it really what you're saying is really a lot. And it sounds really simple to say it equates to value, but that's just really a big statement. Do you think value can easily be segmented then?
When I've always trained marketing managers or salespersons, I'm very specific about the following. The two main things I need to think about, value and segmentation, because the value or the magnitude of the value that an offering provides in the marketplace will be directly tied to the segment they're going after. So some segments value certain things more than others. So the identification of the sub-segments where you're offering a place is critical because that's going to be essential to understand of the value the product and or service offering delivers. It's all about segmentation. In the end, that is what defines the value, the segment, not the other way around. You have to understand your segments, what the unmet need of the segment is, and then address that in the best way that you can with the balance, of course, of the offering relative to cost and relative to the value that it delivers. By the way, I forgot to mention a word. I also called it the branding is a measure of desirability. That's the other, the unmet need. You create desire in an individual to have an item that costs $500. Well, that's the unmet need that you're fulfilling, the desire of something.
What you're talking about just branches off into 100 different areas. So what I may be asking about is probably another branch off of that. You're a product manager, and you're in your job, and the company has been, I'm going to relate it to software right now. And the software that was created was a big hit 5 years ago and has had 5 or 6 versions come out. And you're coming up with the new version. And, you know, the typical thing is to say, what things are missing in here? What do we not have? Do we have to be ready for another operating system? Do we have to move it to a different device? That's the typical questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a very exciting place to be because you're 5 or 6 years into the product, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's really a dead end at that point. How do you identify that and then whether or not you're at a dead end and how you have to branch from that?
Okay, there's two parts of that answer. One, first of all, there's nothing wrong with continuing along the path of incremental innovation. In fact, you must do that to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you must improve your product and increase the features just to keep up. And
right.
That is unfortunately something that our finance guys typically don't understand. You're
right.
Telling me that I need to spend this in so many millions of dollars in R&D folks or in development folks or so many folks, and we're not going to make a cent more? That is tough for somebody who does not have marketplace experience to understand. You
right.
do need to do that just to keep up,
uh-huh.
or somebody else will and will knock you out of business.
Uh-huh.
So there's nothing wrong with that. Now,
right.
how do you know the dead end? And here I'm going to defer, of course, to my, shall I say, the guru of innovation. I call him the Deming of innovation, Clayton Christensen. Clayton Christensen has all this figured out. All of you have read The Innovator's Dilemma and his subsequent books. You've become familiar with his concepts. And in fact, the definitions of the different types of innovations are not mine. They're his. It's in incremental innovation, radical innovation, and disruptive innovation. He has studied this problem in depth. What it boils down to, there's two parts at which he defines that you reach the dead end. When you keep adding features, at some point, two things happen. One, you keep adding cost to your product because you, in essence, keep adding things to it because people keep asking for things and the cost of the product goes up. And what happens is that people who've been asking you for these additional features are the power users of your segment. People who need more, more, they want more. What happens is that you're leaving people behind. People who didn't want more, you're leaving them behind. So, but the problem is that if your product, something happened to your product, two things happened. One, your cost went up because you just kept adding things and you had to increase your prices because, well, you had to. Or two, you made your product too complicated. Too complicated, not for the power users that have been demanding the additional features, and those guys will continue to use them and they will continue to demand more and more features. But to the rest of the folks that didn't want nor needed those additional features, your product just became too complicated for them, too cumbersome, too complex. They don't like it. And that's when the next type of disruption comes in, the disruptive innovation. When a new product comes in from under you with a simpler interface, much simpler, much cleaner, or much easier to use, and they knock you out. So those books are fascinating. And Clayton Christensen's books really molded my view about innovation in a very significant manner. So what I've done is simply taking his approach and his definition of innovation and kind of give him a little bit more practical applications in the sense of the different management processes and how to tie it to value and how to measure it and so on and so forth. His books typically tend to stay at a very high level, but it is plausible to bring it down to a practical product manager level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That's an excellent point that you made, too. And I enjoy the Christensen books because everything he writes for the Harvard Business, it just makes you think about this, the issues every day about how you make these decisions. Particularly this one, I think the black hole is what I tend to think of it as. I had a thought, too, while you were saying that about the cumbersome and listening to the customer and the cumbersome product requirements. How do you, as a practical issue, start to identify that and identify that to the powers that be in the organization?
Well, in many cases, the only solution is to split the product lines. You have to. As to the exact point at which you identify, well, that's the voice of the customer is for, in the sense of you have to keep a very, very close ear to the ground in the sense of people are telling you, they're complaining, they're coming up with a new upgrade, And there are significant complaints out there. Don't ignore them. All those complaints are folks that are going to start peeling out of your product. And the problem is that you have all these other folks that love it. They are folks that are going to be vocal in how they love it and how they like it, how they love these new powerful features. And you have this dichotomy of situations. Well, you tend to typically stay with the folks that love your product and tend to ignore the ones you don't like. You think they're disgruntled or whatever. Then you just ignore them. Very dangerous because those guys will start peeling off the product little by little, or they will be receptive to a new offering in the marketplace. And here's the most difficult part. What you're going to be dealing with technical folks, and I have been the first one to tell you, I used to be in technical, I used to be in R&D, that you need to tell your technical folks, how do I make this product to work not as good as your existing product? You can blow somebody's head with that, but that's what you have to do. You have to design a product with less features that doesn't do as much, that doesn't perform as well, and that's what you have to do. And technical folks will resist fiercely to do this. Fiercely. They simply just, it's very difficult to make them see that you must design product that should not do as many things or perform as well as their current babies. It is a big problem, but it has to be done.
Explain that again. That's a very important point.
And again, I mean, I can refer to it in software or in the chemical industry. I've been in both. And you have a set of features in your current version of the software. You have to slash half of that. Just toothpick the half. Doesn't really matter. Slash half the features and redesign the product.
Uh-huh.
And that's what you need to do. Sometimes you need to rewrite the product from the ground up. That's true. But the whole point is you need to make it much simpler. I mean, with half the features, I mean, the product got better be simpler. If it isn't, then you have another problem. Then you have pretty bad designers. But that's another story. So you have to slash half the features. Or in a technical and engineering field, if you're offering a new material, you have to offer a material that has less heat resistance. And that really, really sets people off. Say, how can I offer a product that has less heat resistance than our current product? Yes, but we have to do it because we have to offer a cheaper product. We have to use other raw materials, whatever we have to do. We have to offer a product that performs not as well as existing offerings. Technical folks simply, it's very difficult for them because they always want to do their best and that their product is always the best. So when you redefine what best is in terms of the specific value to the specific market segment, they have a very hard time understanding it and getting it. That this is where product manager coaching comes in. Mr. Product Manager has to be a very good coach at redefining what best means, best for whom, and redefining different dimensions of best. This segment values these properties more than these, and this other segment values these other properties more than these, than the first ones.
Right. You know, that's got to be tough explaining, though. And getting buy-in on and actually getting that implemented.
It can be done. I've done it, but it is tough. But once they get it, let me tell you, they do miracles. Once they understand, they can do miracles. But they just need to understand why it is important. Why it is not as important to go for the maximum, but rather go for a nice balance.
You know, I worked in the antivirus industry back in the 90s, and having left it about 10 years ago. And one of the things I said at the end of it was that what was needed the most to really cure the sort of the problem, I mean, because none of what's out there does the job, right? It's all reactive software. It's all it's very much like a law enforcement problem. It comes in after the fact, right? And
mm-hmm.
It's up. It really doesn't stop the problem. And I've often said that what they needed to do was have a completely new solution to it. Somebody new, not the current players, were not going to solve the problem because they were too invested in the old way of doing things and carrying legacy ways of doing it because they felt they had to. And this is sort of what you're saying here about delivering something that does less is really key to that, because currently what the products do is they do everything backwards, right? They do everything from 10, 20 years ago, and they can clean up anything from 10 or 20 years ago. But what if you drop that requirement? You don't have to clean up anything that's in the past, and you built this new lightweight product that could scan faster and could find things quicker because it's not having to carry this big baggage on it. And I get that that's sort of what you're saying there, is that if you could just lose some of the older requirements too out of it, you know, just things that you're carrying just because you have to.
Yep.
Because you've told yourself you have to, not because the customer really needs that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're only looking for it to work and fix the problem for you and stop viruses from hitting your system, stop the downtime that you have with those, you know, that's what they want. They don't really care, you know, that you're compliant with something that was out 20 years ago.
Correct. There is no question that you have to come in with a much, a very open mind and a completely different attitude of what the product should do. And that's critical to survive these days. Just the incremental features, well, again, you have to do them to survive. Long term, you're dead because somebody else will knock you off either from below with a simpler product and cheaper product, or somebody will come in from a different. What Christensen calls, and you may recall this, a new market innovation, where you deliver value under a different dimension that you have not considered before, and that's the case of the iPhone. In this case of the BlackBerry, I mean, if you really think about it, the iPhone really didn't do anything that the BlackBerry didn't already do, but did it very differently. They approached the value via design, the design of the user interface. They offer value with a much simpler and much more intuitive user interface, not on features. The iPhone really didn't do much that the BlackBerry didn't use. They got knocked off because they stopped thinking about how and in what other way they could do what they did.
Mhm. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so let's go back to a process style question. So what management system or process would you use in your company or a company use to manage the development of innovation?
Okay. Well, once we center on the definitions, and I don't think we really discussed explicitly how those definitions tie to value, but let's go back to incremental innovation refers to marginal improvements along the same features that you currently offer. That's what incremental or sustaining innovation, as Clayton also calls it, means. Then we do radical innovation. Radical innovation, again, according to Platon, we're still along the same set of features, but we offer an order of magnitude improvement in benefits. And that typically, the example he provides is the change on the smartphones from, or phones in general, from analog to digital. So the order, the difference in the sense of the benefits he provided was an order of magnitude in terms of battery life, in terms of reach in a variety of aspects, but it's still along the same segment. Radical innovation, again, digital, is still innovation along the same features, but an order of magnitude improvement on the features that it offers. Then we have disruptive innovation. Disruptive innovation typically means, again, coming in from below and offer a completely stripped-down product with an order of magnitude in cost of difference, or a completely new way to measure value, like I defined the iPhone, that it came in from the right with a design improvement. So once we have those three definitions, okay, what do we do with them? And I like to kind of look at extremes. Incremental and sustaining innovation typically is managed within the existing business, within the existing P&L. You have the product line, you know the customers, you know everything that you need to know. Your level of uncertainty is low. So classical methods like the stage gating waterfall typically work very well. That's, again, you already have most of the information that you need. You already know most people you need to talk to. So that's fine. Where this breaks down is when you have to want to apply this, what I call linear model, the stage gate and the waterfall, to all the way to the other side of disruptive innovation. That's when they break apart. Because you can't do that. You simply don't have enough information. The level of uncertainty when you're trying to navigate these spaces, where you're trying to determine what new features or what new dimensions to explore, is too much uncertainty. So you must use other methods. You must use methods that typically require a level of iteration. Now, there are methods out there like the Agile and or, well, I don't remember what the other one, Scrum, or no, not Scrum, it's Agile and it has some level of iteration. The only problem with those is that typically by the time you get to use Agile, you already need to have defined the market segment or the space where you are fairly well. So it lacks a little bit of a higher dimension view of things. So actually I created a new process that's a little bit of a higher level that sort of is based on Agile concept of iteration, but it takes some of the tools to manage uncertainty to manage those first stages when you really know very little. I mean, I develop a spiral method for the management of disruptive innovation processes. So So if you look at this as a continuum, you look at the incremental level, you use a stage gate and waterfall. At the radical level, this kind of a mid-ground, you use agile. And at the higher level of disruptive, you can use a method like mine to manage that type of situation.
Okay. Everything you say causes me to pause and think about it a little bit because there are ideas that are new. So if you're causing me to do quite a bit of thinking here, which is a good thing. In that management system, do you see adequate systems out there? Or what percentage of systems do you see that are working out there in companies? And what do you think they need to do to bring it up to speed?
Hi, this is Aris Noel.
How are you?
This is Aris Noel. I'm listening from South Bend, Indiana.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I'm glad to listen. It's pretty interesting stuff.
Great.
Well, I think, again, as you know, Therese and Cindy, StageGate is fairly well entrenched out there in most companies. Some companies have seen that at least they have tried to run at least a two-line process where they use discovery-driven planning as a feeder to the StageGate. I've seen a couple of companies do that. That's a good start, to at least recognize that you must manage some project with high level of uncertainty using a different tool. I believe that more is needed. Again, actually, I call it, you need to almost like two turns at bat, actually, to really get this right. It's like an uphill battle. There's still a lot of evangelizing that we're trying to do to convince people that there are alternatives to stage gate out there and that may be more suitable for disruptive or radical innovation. And by the way, I use stage gate and waterfall interchangeably, just to say that in my mind, they're the same thing.
What's the predominance of Agile now in the marketplace, in your experience right now?
Boy, I don't know what to tell you. What I know is that some companies have tried to hybridize it, that I'm familiar with it. I don't think it's enough. I think, again, because you have to, in essence, that's the same thing that StageGate tried to do. They sort of instituted the spirals within the stages. So some people do Agile within the waterfall. That's not enough because you really have to go back in many cases. And that's where the waterfall and stage gates fail. They don't really let you to go back at the beginning. And that's where they fail. So it's hard to measure because if you go to a company that, we are using Agile, of course, but they're using it within waterfall, well, that's still not going to cut it for the radical disruptive innovation.
Okay. Well, how can you improve your innovation system? That was the second part of that question. How can you go in and start to improve your system at your current company?
Okay. The first step in my mind is a wholesale new classification of projects by level of uncertainty. And this is, again, this is not my idea. This is the kind folks from Wharton, which I had the fortune to train under them, Macmillan and McGrath, which had a book called Entrepreneurial Mindset. We have far many more books after that. But the Entrepreneurial Mindset, they came up with this classification of projects by level of uncertainty. I loved it. In essence, that completely replaced the so-called quadrants, the new product, new market, mainly by substituting. It's not enough to say it's a new product, new market. Within that, there's still a spectrum of different situations. And they blew it up quite dramatically, and then classes did the further subsegmentations around that. So they have a questionnaire where you have to assign points to your project. And in essence, you classify your project according to how much you do not know, not how much you know, how much you do not know. Once you have that, well, at least you already step ahead of almost everybody as to, okay, now understanding that where your projects fall as to how much knowledge you still need to gather, boy, that's a long, you've already done a lot of progress because then it gives you a better idea of how much work is ahead of you. Now, as to, again, what process and method you use afterwards is up to you. Again, I'm biased because I have my own system, but at least you should start with that. Classify projects with method of uncertainty. It's the Entrepreneurial Mindset from Macmillan and McGrath.
Okay, that sounds good. Entrepreneurial Mindset. You think that there needs to be a seed of entrepreneurship in all product managers?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think it's without saying that product managers that are not entrepreneurial will not be successful. Bottom line is, I think Cindy said something about herding cats. I mean, that's really the job description. So, entrepreneurial is a requirement because, again, it's about navigating all the waters, choppy and uncertain and dangerous and full of sharks. And very few people are going to tell you what to do. That's, to me, it's a requirement. even within a company, not just in a startup, within a large corporation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Cindy, did you have anything you wanted to add? I mean, I've just had so many questions, but I feel like there were some things you wanted to add in here.
You're doing great, Therese. I'm trying to continue the conversation out on Twitter. There has been a couple of people. Someone came in earlier, Evan Wolf, and he is very interested in the innovation ecosystem. So he was asking, what are the product manager's roles in invention and innovation processes, Jose? And I suggested to him that we might address that. And so now is a good time, but I didn't know if you can speak to that.
Well, I don't think, Cindy, you know my opinion about product management. In my mind, the discipline of product management is the discipline that best qualifies to manage innovation, period. Any type of innovation. Unfortunately, the classical, shall I say, training of product managers tend to be focused on the incremental part, but that's simply because it's been, shall I say, historical. But there's nobody better qualified, certainly not what I call classical marketing managers. Classical marketing managers, as you know, tend to be worried more about the branding and the advertising and all that. To me, product managers are it. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that the person has received the training they need to tackle a bigger project in a disruptive sense, because they have always been working on the incremental side. Like it can be addressed, and that's what organizations like the Therese's organization can come in very handy. And then there are, of course, a number of companies that offer training. I think, again, some of them address this issue with some success, some of them just do not. But to me, they should be the drivers. They are, they need to, they're the ones, they're the connection between the marketplace and the technical folks, the intermediaries. They're the ones, the only ones really can put it all together. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent answer. The thing that I see, and certainly with the product management training, we have an innovation leadership program that we've come up with, two people for Colorado State University. And the problem is what I see is that most of the time the innovation is done in the product development section, in the R&D, or in the project management area. It's not handed into the product management area because the product management area seems to be focused on not only just the process of managing the products, but probably the marketing of the product itself. Not so much in the innovation piece where there's really three parts of the product management. You know, there's the creation and then there's the management and marketing parts of it. So we see that companies don't necessarily see the product management piece as being their best product managers as being one of the best leaders in that area. And it's a process of working with them to open their eyes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it will happen. I know because it's the organic way it should be done. And ultimately, things sort of lead into, you know, they sort of find their way back to the organic method, right? You know, as everything sort of points north, you know, you can't, you know, you can try to shift the compass, but it always goes back. With the process, I think it's ultimately going to go there. But at the current time, I see a lot of resistance to that idea.
Well, yeah, change won't come easy, but they will. I mean, some change will happen whether they want it or not. Bottom line is that you have the market is now littered with the carcasses of companies who have resisted this, and they soon will be littered with a few more like BlackBerry and Nokia, and they'll continue to resist until they die. So at some point, some upper management will realize, hey, you know what? Being successful in innovation requires that we change with the way we do things. It won't work to just continue to do things the same way we're doing them. It's not working. Now, it may take a lot of time, but I do realize that, and a few survivors will change things.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I think about, I go back when I was in high school and taking economics, and certainly when I was in college and took economics too, but I remember when I first got the concept of the GDP, and I realized this is the cumulative total of all the products and, you know, all the goods and services sold, right? And this is a function of how we measure the success and the health of an economy. And, you know, when GDP goes up, that you've got this healthy economy because new products are coming out, goods and services are just flowing, And so when you see the shrinkage of GDP by, and then of course it's compared to debt, which is another whole other issue, but that's when I realized the amount of goods and services are out there. I mean, when you start to look at that number and you see it's got to grow 1 or 2% for some health, and that means you've got to come up with a lot of new things, a lot of new products, you know, because you're talking trillions of dollars, right? And in order for 1% of $1 trillion, that's a lot of incremental growth. And so there's a lot that has to happen in the delivery of these goods to create that much. And it's a daunting task, I think, sometimes when you think about that. We've got to keep coming up with new and better products and something different. And so there's this, not all these Me Too products, because that tends to draw the numbers down, right? Because things become so cheap because there's so many of the same thing out there.
And again, there is nothing wrong with keeping up. Again, something you have to do what you have to do to survive. The problem is to rely on that strategy long term. That's what kills you.
Right, right. Understood. Yeah, it's just an amazing amount of dollars and things that you have to think about in terms of producing and what that means ultimately to, number one, to your company, number two, to your economy and your market. There's just a lot to be done. I love products, so I wouldn't have done what I did for so many years and be doing what I'm doing right now if I didn't just love new products, love the challenge of creating a new service or or something durable or something to be held in your hand or something to be, like I mentioned earlier, a movie. It's all part of the creation process and innovation process.
Excuse me, so earlier John Newbery, who is joining us from England, and he's an upcoming speaker, and he was answering the early question about how do you define innovation. He said that, so typical and non-technical companies, innovation is incorrectly defined as products less than X years old and measured as a percentage of sales.
Yeah, some companies dangerously fall into that trap. You set a goal for the R&D manager or for the commercial manager. In 5 years, two-thirds of your sales must be of new products. Well, how do you define your products? What ends up happening is that it's a plethora of new products that they launch with this like tweaks, and they can meet their goal. Yeah, but again, they devote so many resources to an artificial goal that they don't devote enough resources to game changers, and then in 10 years, out of business. Yeah, I've seen that actually several times already.
Yes, and Evan Wolf is concerned with ecosystems around innovation. He asked, what does the innovation ecosystem look like and do? When I asked him to speak more to that, he said an innovation ecosystem sometimes includes tech media, investors, R&D, education, early customers, etc.
Yeah, of course, the number one example, and of course we have to bring it up again, is Apple. I mean, the iPod, not the iPhone, the iPod was successful not just because it was a better design, but also because of the introduction of iTunes. So again, yes, innovation is not just products, it's the entire system of offering services and a business model that you bring into the marketplace. And really, that's what really made it an incredible success, redefining the offering of music, right? And then selling also a very nice, cool gadget to go with it. But it was the iTunes that really sealed the deal. So it's, again, I want to emphasize, we're not just talking about products. The issue of invention and value is applicable across anything. iTunes delivered significant value to the end user by providing a very easy way to acquire digital music at a very reasonable price. That's value. And that's why they were so successful.
Excellent. So did we address, I know the answer to this, Jose, but I want to make sure that we covered all of the questions. Q10 was, do you believe that different types of innovation need different management processes?
Yeah, I want to reiterate the dangerous mistake that companies make today is to use one process, one method, one software package that was designed with certain things in mind, particularly very well suited for incremental innovation, and start applied across the board, and they typically fail. I realize that this doesn't win me many friends, but with the StageGate system, I call it the killer of projects. It's really what it becomes. Typically, a product that has a lot of uncertainty and which is typically the case when you're into the radical disruptive innovation arena, it gets killed very quickly on stage because you cannot provide enough information to pass the gates. So what it means is that you must have a separate process that understands that the initial stages is all about gathering information and reducing the level of uncertainty. You only get into stage gate when you're already pretty much on the final iteration, but you're getting close to commercial launch.
I do want to thank our tweeters. And John Newberry has a last remark. He says that incremental innovations can have very different requirements to disruptive innovations. So he's agreeing, and they require a different approach. Thank you, John. I want to thank again the AIPMM for sponsoring us. Definitely, I did tweet out the URL to check out the Certified Innovative Leader training, which is very valuable, very rich curriculum. It's a several-day intensive, and I will add that to the Twitter transcript. Thank you, Jose, for joining us. If you check out our today's resources, Jose's presentations, where he talks about this in more depth, are available. Coming up next week on the Global Product Management Talk, Hector De Castilla is joining us to talk about product management and mentoring and how to forward your career, how to get involved in a mentor relationship, and creating the culture of mentoring to benefit both the mentor and the mentee. The AIPMM webinar coming up this week, Thursday, is about the project management and product management view of high-performing teams. Go to AIPMM.com to check out the webinars. Thank you again, Jose. Closing remarks, and Therese.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us. Let me just close with one, my favorite poster child for the difference between innovation and invention, the Segway. I still can't believe that even that Steve Jobs might have thought that was going to be the greatest thing in the world. Why some young product manager didn't Google the scooter on Amazon.com before they launched and priced that thing, I'll never know. But I mean, it is the classic one. Whenever anybody's asking you the difference between invention and innovation, one word, the Segway. That's it.
Okay, that's a great point. Thank you, Jose.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Jose Briones, for joining us. Thank you, Therese Padilla, for serving as co-host. I had to tweet out the segue as the example between the difference between innovation and invention. So are you saying that the segue was not an innovative invention?
No, it was not. It was a cute, it was a cool invention, but it's absolutely not an innovative product. Just Google scooter on Amazon.com and see, you'll see what I mean. Or search for scooters on Amazon.com.
Oh, scooters. So yeah. You're saying the Segway, it was just an innovative scooter. It was not
It was a very expensive scooter. That's all it was.
Okay.
Not an innovative scooter. A very expensive scooter that didn't even offer you a seat.
Yeah, it's a great example. I think it's great.
So yes, it was the Rolls Royce of scooters.
It was the Rolls Royce of scooters, yes.
Without a seat.
Without a seat, but you didn't get a seat with it. You spent $10,000, but you actually didn't get a seat with it.
It totally was all about the customer experience, because they are fun, but then they're boring after the fun passes.
Yeah, I mean, look at the popularity of, is it the Vespa? And then I looked at the new BMW scooter, and then you think of the Segway. It's like hardly the same.
Well, except that there was not a market for it, or it's a very long tail finding the market fit. Do you not think that the Segway was responding to a value in a market segmentation? Certainly the inventors saw the value, or thought they did.
I'm sure somebody saw the value, but I don't think he got it right. I think they made a big mistake with it. I think they saw the value in shopping mall cars. I don't think they meant that was the original target segment for that particular product. I think that they thought they were going to revolutionize transportation, and the very first question I asked is, why should I buy a $10,000 scooter when I can go to Amazon.com, buy a $500 scooter that does exactly the same thing?
So great. So thank you again. We appreciate you being because
thank you.
And I look forward to that you will also be presenting a webinar on this issue with the AIPMM coming up. So I look forward to you going into more depth with a visual on that event. Again, thank you to the AIPMM for sponsoring, and please join us again next week if you follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. You will get reminders. Have a great week.
Thank you.